Welcome to the ACOFP Student Podcast, a production of the American College of Osteopathic Family Physicians.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the ACOFP DO.FM Podcast. I am Brandon Ryan, a third-year medical student from the New York Institute of Technology College of Osteopathic Medicine.
And I'm Mercedes Hess, a third-year medical student from Kansas City University.
We're both members of the National Student Executive Board of the Student Association of the American College of Osteopathic Family Physicians. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing direct primary care, also known as DPC. I am thrilled to introduce our guest, Dr. Jack Forbush. He's a family medicine physician who owns his own practice up in Hamden, Maine, discussing his journey into direct primary care and why he chose this model over traditional insurance-based practice. He'll explain what DPC is, how it transforms the physician-patient relationship, and how it aligns with osteopathic principles. The conversation will also explore the challenges and rewards of running an independent practice. And finally, he'll offer us some advice for students and residents interested in family medicine and an alternative practice model.
So to get things started, tell us a little bit about yourself, where are you from, and what your journey in medicine has kind of looked like, and then kind of what originally drew you to family medicine and being an osteopath in general.
Well, sure, but I would be remiss to say if those aren't some tall orders that you folks just gave in the intro, I'm sure there are going to be some people that think you might have had the wrong guest on, but that's okay. So my journey to medical school, I'll be somewhat brief in that I actually started out as a medic and firefighter in my local hometown and then realized I didn't want to be 50 and moving people up and down stairs. So I went to nursing school, worked in ER, ICU, special care units, et cetera. And kind of a weird kind of spiritual epiphany, if you will, that just felt that I was going to go to medical school. So that's how I ended up at the University of New England, College of Osteopathic Medicine, and then did my residency in Bangor and fellowship there as well, and worked in private practice with another group, then for the local hospital system, and started my own practice in 2007. Converted it to direct primary care 2014. My only regret is that I didn't convert my practice earlier.
So why did you choose family medicine over all the other specialties?
So that's another interesting story. I mean, most people that I worked with fully expected me to either do emergency medicine, critical care, or orthopedic surgery, because I really enjoy orthopedics and sports medicine. And I also enjoy OB. So I had all these kind of seemingly disconnected different specialties that I really enjoyed. And I really found family medicine to be the unifying specialty. And I think I'm kind of, in a way, I'm a bit of an old dinosaur. I still deliver babies. You know, I still do all the primary care stuff, still see people in the hospital. But family medicine was really the perfect fit for me. And I knew it would be much more of a cognitive challenge than doing a specialty. You know, I just think I really enjoy the cognitive challenge involved with in family medicine that you frankly don't get in any other specialty.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm kind of the same way, like full scope family medicine is kind of what I want to do. I really enjoy OB, but not really enough to kind of do that for my whole life. So I like
Listen, it's fantastic being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what your problem is. It's great. It's wonderful. Sleep. It's wonderful having a pocket full of meconium. There's nothing wrong with that.
That is true. And nothing better than getting to deliver someone's baby. So
you better believe it.
Absolutely incredible. And definitely a unique path. So I'd love to have you just tell us a little bit more about direct primary care. I know a lot of people are unfamiliar with it. When we met you at the conference last year out in Palm Springs, which we're hoping to see you and everyone else in Orlando this year, you introduced us to this concept of direct primary care. For those of us who might not be familiar, could you explain exactly what it is and how it differs from your traditional business practice?
Sure. So, I mean, and now this model now has not just a name, but a nice, sexy acronym, DPC. It kind of sounds like a rap band or something like that, like AC/DC, heavy metal, but AC/DPC. So at the heart of it, it's a membership model through which patients independently contract or agree or sign up for a membership with a physician. DPC, primary care, is predominantly family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, et cetera. But it's a model that eschews working for somebody else other than the patient. So our current third-party system, i.e. what's your copay, what's your insurance company, I'm going to bill that company for my services, is really nothing more to be honest, than an employment model with an insurance company. Because, Brandon, if you're my patient or Mercedes, for example, and I bill your insurance company, that's who's paying me to take care of you. As opposed to the direct primary care model where you have a membership, you're paying me. So you and I have this relationship outside of having this third party in the middle of us, if you will. It would almost be like taking an extra date to the prom in a way. That's probably a bad analogy. But if I'm working directly for you and you're getting your services from me, that 2 + 2 equation is very easy. As opposed to when you bring in, a third party payer system, then you bring in all of the things that they expect me or you to comply with. And it just really is very obtrusive to patient care and inefficient. So it's a direct payment system between patients and physicians.
Wonderful. Could you explain a little bit more, if it is at all distinctive, how it's distinctive from concierge medicine? I feel like a lot of times people can get that confused.
Yeah, they get that confused all the time. Most of the time it gets confused by people who are self-proclaimed experts in health policy and experts in direct primary care, but they don't know the difference. Concierge is still billing the third-party system, but you have some kind of executive fee or convenience fee or accessibility fee in addition to the physician billing the applicable third-party system. So the physician hasn't escaped the shackles, if you will, of the third-party system. They've just kind of made themselves feel better about adding on an additional charge. So how that pragmatically plays out, the patient comes in, pays their copay, the doctor bills the third party insurance, and then the patient has the privilege of paying the doctor extra for the things that we in direct primary care do all the time for the same price.
Got it. Thank you for clearing that up. What does being a member of your DPC practice cover? What's the scope of your practice?
Yeah, so we do birth to death, taxes in between, still do deliveries, still take care of hospital patients. I do ton of osteopathic treatment, sports medicine, well woman, well man care. It's basically the definition of full spectrum family medicine. So our membership fee encompasses all the services that we provide, accessibility, as well as access to my purchasing power, whether it be wholesale prices on medications, wholesale prices on lab testing, wholesale prices on a pair of crutches or medical equipment. So anything that the patient can take advantage of my purchasing ability as a physician, they have access to. So that's kind of what our practice involves. Some states do not allow dispensing of medications, so I don't want to be too forward in saying that all states do that, but certainly our state does. And as a result, we save people a lot of money, a lot of hassle, and a lot of rigmarole.
That's awesome. Do your patients still maintain some other form of insurance
I
usually?
would say conservatively, 80% of our patients do not have any third-party healthcare coverage. They have nothing. And of the other 20%, which is probably even less than that, I would say half of those have a non-functioning high catastrophic plan where their deductible is, $15,000 to $20,000 or whatever. It's a very small percentage of patients that actually have a reasonable third-party insurance vehicle. But like I said, most of our patients, 80% at the least, at the mo at the very least, I should say, don't have any healthcare coverage at all. We are their healthcare coverage. Now, we tell everybody you should get something, in case you have a major catastrophe, a car accident, major illness, or you're in the hospital. And a lot of those folks will entertain or try to get into enrollment into one of the sharing ministries, quote unquote, or sharing funds. But even that has a cost prohibitive nature.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for kind of describing what DPC is. I feel like, especially as a student, like Brandon and I were saying, even as a second year, no, we'd never heard of DPC before. So I think it's a really good option for a lot of students who are thinking family med or even residents. So we appreciate you explaining that for us.
Oh, you're welcome. Hopefully, I did a somewhat cogent job.
You did great. So we kind of talked a little bit about your path earlier, but in how you said that you wish you would have done DPC sooner. So, can you
Yeah.
walk us through your path from residency to eventually opening your like DPC practice?
Yeah. Sure. So when I graduated residency, there was still a very high percentage of physician offices that were independent. So the dynamic of being a hospital-owned practice is a relatively new development. So when I graduated, I worked for a multi-physician family medicine office that has since been in, was subsequently engulfed by FQHC. But I worked for them, and just shortly before they were bought out for all intensive purposes by the FQHC, I opted to finish out my fellowship and go back to work for the local hospital system. So I did that for a year and a half or 2 years and used that opportunity to kind of strategize and plan my next step, which was to open my own practice. And I did that in 2007. And then from 2007 to 2014, when I converted my practice, particularly the last couple of years, really became untenable and unbearable as far as practicing medicine. Just really the increasing administrative burden with trying to provide fairly straightforward medical care got to the point where it was really psychologically very damaging, to be honest with you. It was almost as though you were a hostage to a system that didn't care about you and didn't care about the patients and just really cared about their bottom line and trying to deflect payment for services for as long as possible. And to be very frank with you, I became a very mean, ugly, undesirable person to be around and came to the point where I said I either need to change what I do or go hand out smiley stickers at the local Walmart and tell people that Oreos are in aisle 7. And at the time, PC didn't exist. There was no framework. So I had a good colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Champy, who practices in South Portland. He was kind of going through the same struggle. And between the two of us, we put this plan, if you will, together. And then while doing so, we realized that a whole other bunch of people across the country were having very similar ideas. So our practices were a couple hours apart. We're the first in the state to do it and really develop the framework for a lot of the other practices, almost all the other practices in New England to use as a launching pad. The cool thing about it is that we had no idea other people across the country were doing this. We just thought we were two stupid Mainers trying to figure out a solution. So it was really, really a renaissance in a way of thinking. So you look at folks like Ron Newhoffel or Vance Lassie or Josh Umber or even prior to them, Garrison Bliss, et cetera. But we had no idea who those people were. Like we didn't even know they existed until you start putting this thing together and you hear this person's doing that and this person's doing that. So, but it was really driven by my complete dissatisfaction with life and medicine specifically, that I just really decided I had to do something. Had to do something different, or like I said, Oreos in aisle 7, here's your smiley sticker.
Yeah, I think burnout, I feel like people kind of undermine it a little bit. And I feel like people don't realize that it's happening or happening as frequently until they're living it. And so I
Yeah.
think that, yeah, finding like what works best for you or something that you're more passionate about and that is better for you and your patients, I think is definitely the compromise and the way to go when practicing medicine.
Oh, entirely. And you know, that's part of what drives that. Those pain points are a lot of what drives those of us who have been doing it a long time to prevent people from having to be rescued. Like we want to help practicing physicians and residents not have to go through the pain and the suffering and the burnout and all that sort of stuff that we had to go through. We don't want people to have to enter that, you know, room in Armageddon or Hades, if you will.
Yeah, for sure. So we're kind of going to move on more to like the direct primary care model, like
By all
kind of
means.
your day-to-day life kind of. So first kind of question is, how does DPC change the physician-patient relationship in your day-to-day practice, kind of compared to, like working for a big hospital system
Yeah.
or a larger practice?
Whether you like it or not, it makes it much more personal, much more intimate, much more meaningful, and from a workflow perspective, much more efficient. So when you have, instead of the 7 minutes for the office visits that you have for the patient, our appointments are either 30 or 60 minutes blocked off. When you have the opportunity to actually learn who this person is in your examination room and learn who their family is and their social system and the kind of the ecology of their world, things just get easier. Now, they also get harder because they ask you a lot more questions about how to figure things out. They'll say, well, listen, I can't get into my endocrinologist for 9 months. What do you think about X, Y, and Z? So it does require you to really up your game as far as research and cognitive depth and things that, but then it's also, that's a nice thing too. Like, for example, I had this whole, just today, I had this whole conversation about genetic testing for hemochromatosis. Now, that's not something I deal with every week as a family medicine doc, but the patient came in and said, hey, I've been having X, Y, and Z. And by the way, I found out my father had chromatosis and developed liver failure. Like, well, that's kind of interesting. So rather than just shuffle that person off to a gazillion specialists that they might see in the next decade, you know, we could actually sit down and I could dust off the marbles, if you will, in my head and say, I remember learning about this somewhere. Let's kind of go down this path and really develop a good diagnostic plan for the individual that day. So it's things like that that are really incredibly fulfilling for me. Also, as I mentioned, a lot of these things can be challenging because the patients who are really hungry for good, efficient medical care will push our cognitive ability quite a bit. I hate to keep using that term, but really it's like you really do have to be very willing to entertain things that you might have learned years ago that you don't necessarily do. But that's kind of exhilarating at the same time. It's like, wow, I can actually sit back and learn. I can relearn about insulomas, for example, or the patient who came in a few months ago exhibiting myasthenia gravis, or like all of this sort of stuff. So it can be daunting sometimes, but it's really, I hate to say it's kind of cool, but it is kind of cool. Like, you get to be a doctor.
That's really good to hear, because I think from anyone's perspective, trying to see six patients in an hour is not feasible in family medicine.
I don't know about you, but it takes me more than a couple minutes to say, hey, how are you today? What's going on? Oh, I see you got new glasses. Or I got, by the time you've done that, and also accounting for the time that one of you has to go to the bathroom, then the visit's over. Mm-hmm. You've accomplished nothing.
Right. Yeah. And something I noticed even during my rotation is kind of when they send in the student, they would like, just ask them about like their top priority. Like, what's the one thing that you can talk about today? Right. And then we'll have them come back and talk about like their other stuff. And it's like, there should be like an efficient way to just be able to try and go through what they want to go through.
So, I mean, the nice, what we take, oh my gosh, we probably have 15 students a year in our office, and they're very shocked when patients come in with their list of questions and we're not upset about it. And so where's your list of things you want to talk about? Is there anything else you want to, you know, anything else you need to get off your chest? I don't mind if you wanted to come back and talk about this, but you probably have other things to get to, like work or the kids or, you know, grandma or whatever. So why don't we just try and take care of things today? So give me your list, please.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like that also helps with compliance. I feel like the amount of times I see patients referred out to different things and things that I feel like as a physician, you should be trained to do that can be accomplished in an office visit, being like, all right, come back, we'll do that another time, or, you know, go see this person, we'll go over it. It just makes me feel like it's that much harder for the patient to get the care that they deserve.
Well, it's fractured. That's the thing, because one of the realities is we all have lives. And if someone has taken off the time for work or had to drop their kid off to daycare or had to help get their grandmother to their mother or grandmother, whomever, to the office, and then they have to do that again, that just perpetuates the obstacles to people getting affordable and efficient care. So why not just try to take care of things when you can take care of things, as opposed to deferring it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sure you see differences in outcome, satisfaction, continuity in your DPC life compared to the type of way you were practicing before.
Oh, entirely. You know, so our no-show rate is probably less than 1%. Like when patients schedule an appointment, with rare exception, they're there because they know they're going to get stuff taken care of. And they know that we're not going to scurry them out the door after 4.3 seconds because we have to move on to the next patient. So the compliance with showing up for appointments and the compliance with actually doing things is incredibly high, because I can look at you, Mercedes or Brandon, and I can say, here's why I'm recommending that we do X, Y, and Z, and here's the effect if you do them, and here's the effect if you don't do them. So lots
Yeah.
of patient education.
Amazing. So tell us a little more. What does your typical day in the practice look like? How many patients are you seeing? What kind of disease processes are you
Sure.
encountering?
So what's today's today's two, so we work Monday, Fridays are only half day. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays are full day, meaning seven to four. I think I had four or five this afternoon, maybe six, maybe seven this morning. So we'll say 12 to, I'll say 12 to 15, because some kid always gets thrown in because they have the sniffles or something happens. So we'll say 15 patients, just for argument's sake. And those can really be a mishmash of a lot of things. So let's see. So today, let me go work in reverse. So the last four of the day was an annual well woman visit combined with some OMT. And then I had a couple, actually OMT was all this afternoon, intermixed with severe degenerative end stage osteoarthritis, annual health visit, low back pain, like a lot of those kind of musculoskeletal complaints the last part of the day. But this morning, let's see, a couple of well child examinations, circumcision, OB visit, a couple of acutes, people who had man colds, so to speak, and they thought they were dying. And then let's see, had shoulder two shoulder injections, and that's pretty typical for the day. I would say it's a pretty good mishmash of preventive healthcare, meaning adults or kids, chronic disease management, acute, intermixed with a whole bunch of osteopathic treatment.
Wow, it's so refreshing to hear this all-encompassing practice.
Like I said, we're old dinosaurs because I'm foolish. That's what it comes down to.
In a rural state like Maine, how has DPC helped you address stuff like access, cost, and like we've kind of been talking about already, continuity? It seems like you have a very well-known patient population. That how is it received to the people around you?
Well, so that's kind of an interesting story. I'm going to give you a little bit of history, but I've got some time, because when I first converted my practice, I had an absolutely stellar marketing thrust by the local hospitals. And when I say that, it was really they were attempting to provide bad press, meaning that I'm going to be cherry picking the patients, that I'm abandoning people, that I'm an evil doctor with a wart on the end of my nose, and all this sort of stuff. And the funny thing is that a lot of people said essentially, wow, if they're making this much of a fuss over this little small family medicine office, I should probably go check that out just to see what they're doing different. So it ended up being a real watershed moment as far as the practice is concerned, because even to this day, and we've been doing it for, well, 12 years, we still routinely have meet and greet sessions with patients. People who want to establish care, or hey, can you take care of my sister's family, or can you take care of can you take care of dad because he can't get into wherever. So it's been very well received by, and not just my local area, but we pull people that travel 2 or 3 hours to come see us just because of the ge just because of the geography of Maine.
That's amazing. They say all press is good press, right? It sounds like
Exactly.
you guys a favor.
It was fantastic. I was like very happy. I mean, I was initially kind of aggravated about it because I worked for these people and then they were bad mouthing me. But I really then realized, hey, this is fantastic. They're giving me all this free publicity. This is great.
Exactly.
This is fantastic.
I had a little bit of a follow-up question actually about that. So are patients like surprised when they come from your mainstream, primary care to
Yeah.
DPC, just in like you were explaining, just how much more personal it gets and how much more time you actually kind of spend with them, getting to know them?
Yeah, so here's a pretty regular new patient behavior. So they come in and they do their meet and greet, and they say, yeah, you promise all these things, but we're willing to give you a shot. And then they actually start to experience it. And then they start to see whether or not it's real. Like, is the doctor really going to answer the phone? Are they really going to respond to this text message? Are they really going to respond to this email? So you have a bit of an initial utilization that dies off after a month because you've proven, like, yes, I am going to answer this phone. And yes, we do answer emails. And yes, we do answer secure messages. And yes, we do this. So in a way, they are trying to prove the things that we're saying that we're doing in a way and really testing the waters to see if we are as different than the system that they're coming from. That if that makes any kind of weird sense. And then what happens is they become marketers. Then they, Jennifer goes home and says to her sister Heather, "Hey, you wouldn't believe this. It's like you got to take your kids here or whatever."
That's awesome. Yeah, that's super cool to hear. Kind of moving on a little bit. How you were talking about OMT earlier, OMM. So how do you actually like integrate it into your practice?
I integrate it in the same way that I listen to someone's heart and chest.
Wow.
So I'm an osteopathic physician. I learned how to do physical examination. So I learned to listen to a person's heart and their lungs and check their ears and tap their kneecap and look in their eyeballs. And I learned how to perform a structural examination, whether it's applicable or not, because you get a lot of good information
Right.
from people. It's in my mind, a structural examination is the same as the same importance than listening to a heart exam. Okay. Now there may be situations where you use more of it or use less of it, but nonetheless, it would be very akin to never listening to somebody's heart.
Right.
It would be akin to an ophthalmologist never looking in somebody's eyeballs.
Exactly.
Okay. It would be akin to an orthopedic surgeon never replacing a knee or a hip. No, but it's, I know it sounds strange, but that's kind of part of what we learn. So why am I not utilizing it? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I definitely agree because I feel like in even in med school, they're like, yeah, half of you, like most of you won't even like use this when you're like out in practice. Or I feel like even in residency, it does get harder, you know, because like do all residencies offer OMM and this and that?
Right.
So I feel
Well,
like, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I was going to make a here's something I tell students all the time because I hear that a lot. I don't have time to do OMT. I don't have the opportunity to do it. Well, that's your own fault. That's your own fault to some degree. You ne I'm no good in it. I'm not proficient in it. So I say to the students, I'm going to put this X-ray up on this screen, and I want you to give me a very detailed, extensive, comprehensive diagnostic interpretation of this chest X-ray. And like, what do you mean? What do you mean? You can't do that until you've looked at 1,000 chest X-rays. I want you to listen to the next patient's heart, and I want you to tell me whether or not they have a grade one systolic ejection murmur. You don't increase your physical examination skills or diagnostic skills unless you actually practice them. So you're only going to get good at listening to the heart if you listen to the heart. You're only going to get good at looking at chest X-rays if you look at chest X-rays. You're only going to get good at structural examinations if you is if you if you, you're only going to get good at them by doing it. So if you don't do it, you're going to continue to suck at it. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, you don't use it, you lose it.
Exactly. It's no, it's and the nice thing, the cool thing, one of the cool things about doing the osteopathic evaluation is a lot of it becomes muscle energy. I mean, muscle memory, pardon me. Because muscle memory, you're examining this, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I've seen that before. What's that? What's this little tissue texture? And it may mean nothing, but if you didn't touch somebody's arm, you'd never find it. Or if you didn't do whatever, you're not going to find a cardiac murmur unless you listen to the heart.
Absolutely. It's amazing to hear. Moving more into the idea of, you know, the practice itself, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced when starting your DPC practice, both financially and professionally?
Well, so let's see. Financially, I had a huge amount of money that was owed to me by the insurance companies, which I just opted to forget about. So that was one. I think the biggest thing is I didn't have any framework. Like I had no idea how to put something of this together. So almost as though we're writing the plan as we go. But even having said that, I think one of the biggest struggles for me then, and which I often find is the most significant hurdle to physicians now, is thinking too much about things. And by that, I mean this. Running a business, when it comes right down to it, is very akin to buying groceries. I have $100 to buy groceries. I don't want to spend 101 because I don't have the extra dollar. I need to determine what's the most appropriate thing for me to buy to eat. I could buy $100 worth of Oreo cookies that would not be great for my health. But I probably need to buy some fruits and some vegetables and some meat and some milk and some cheese. I need to kind of do that. So when it comes to running a business, you do need to keep that in your mind about having a budget as far as income and expenses. You always want to hold it back. So that's one of the things I think was not the spending part, but wrapping my head around, yes, I'm running a medical practice, but really I'm running a business. I'm running a business that happens to provide healthcare. In many ways, I'm running a very similar to I'm running a business as a plumber. I'm running a business as a carpenter. So there's the business aspect of things. And I think physicians just think too much about things. I think they overcomplicate it. They're stuck in trying to remember the various steps of the Krebs cycle when it comes to running a business. Okay.
Yeah.
No,
Yeah.
running a business is not the Krebs cycle. Okay. You don't have to go through this. It really, really trying to maintain the simplicity approach. This is the income I have. Here are my expenses. I need to keep those in balance. Do I really need this wonderful 3D ultrasonic, whatever widget? Or can I get by for a while until I can pay cash for that? But I think it's that's a huge obstacle for a lot of physicians that I talk to who I need to get an MBA to run my business. No, you don't. Just stop buying Oreos. Just really break this down into simple steps.
Yeah, I definitely fall in that camp of overthinking. So it's definitely a mindset I think a lot of people share and we have to get out of if we want to become successful in this field.
Agree.
And I also feel like whether you're a physician or not, I think we all need to learn how to manage our finances.
So I will tell you, at the same time we decided to, well, I should say we, I made the decision. I waited a week until my wife was out of town, three states away, and I told her so that she wouldn't kill me. But at the same time, we made a commitment to go debt-free. And so, and we run our business. We do not run our business on credit. We pay cash for pretty much everything. If we have to use a debit card, we don't, well, a debit card or credit, we pay it off at the end of the month. And so the way that we've structured this, and we kind of take this approach that you should be paying for everything before you actually have, like you should have the money ahead of time. And then you have to have money in reserve and you have to have an emergency fund and you've got to have some of this buffer. So we've structured ourselves in such a way that we have an ongoing emergency fund for example, the dryer just went. So we had to buy a new dryer, but we already had that money set aside. If I get hit by a Mack truck, the office stays operational for at least 6 months.
Wow.
But that requires a level of discipline that, frankly, a lot of people struggle with. Not just doctors, but just people in general.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. My car was in the auto shop last week. So
There you go. Yeah.
I understand that. So I guess for like physicians who are a little more weary or they do get into the weeds about details of having their own
Yeah.
practice or DPC, like what kind of financial benefits does the DPC kind of model offer to physicians who are weary of not having like benefits of being with more like
Well,
corporate
yeah,
corporations?
I think the biggest thing is having them step back and saying, are these really benefits or do they just feel like benefits? So, for example, I get a $20,000 sign-on bonus. Well, yeah, but you've got to give an extra so many years in order to maintain that. So that value, that monetary proposition really becomes much less significant because you have to extend your time. Well, they're giving me $2,500 of CME money. Okay, but you do know that if you run your own business and certain business entities, then that becomes a cost of the company, not a cost of you, for example. So I think reframing what it means, people ask me all the time, what do you bring home as a salary personally? And I say to them, to be honest with you, I have no idea. I have no idea. I don't know. Maybe it's 10 bucks. Maybe it's 100 bucks. I have no idea, because if you strategically structure your business in a way, a lot of those things that you otherwise would have had a personal expenditure for really becomes a business expenditure. So everything from you feel, and I'm no, I should, a little bit of a disclaimer here. I do not offer financial advice. I encourage everyone listening to this to talk to a professional, but they'll give you kind of the same information that, there are advantages to the various business structures and entities that far exceed a larger paycheck at the end of the week.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when we first discussed this last year, you kind of broke it down in like simple math terms for us, for those of us who are like, I'm coming out of school with XYZ $1,000 of debt. I'm gonna be in residency where, I have to do that to get my training. I'm not gonna be making a lot. That's just the nature of residency nowadays. How am I gonna be able to enter the world and try and set up a business while I'm already behind? And you kind of explained it, I'm not sure if you're able to do it again, that the math's out at the end of the day if you do it right.
Oh, the math. I don't want to get into too many details because I'll probably get held by maybe the ACLP attorney will call me up or say you can't say that. No, but the math really does work out in your favor. It does require a couple of caveats. So the first caveat is, yes, you're a doctor and you've graduated residency, but maybe you ought to wait a couple of years before you get the Lamborghini. Okay? Like, don't give yourself a little bit of liberty, but don't go overboard and buy golden handcuffs. So lighten the sacrifice up a bit, but don't completely let the reins go free. So having some continued restraint is important. If you're able to keep the restraint together, and if you're able to understand that patients come to see you for your brain, your diagnostic acumen, if you will, your listening skills, your problem-solving skills, they don't come to you because you've got a 3D EKG machine. They don't come to you because you've got the $1,600 ophthalmoscope. They don't come to you because you've got cool widgets. They come to you because they come to you because of your brain, your heart, your willingness, and your intelligence and your intellect. When it comes down to it, you can run a DPC practice, as a good friend of mine, Craig Schult, will say, Dr. Craig Schult. You can run your DPC practice with a stethoscope and a cell phone. And that's the reality behind it, is you can't. So that comes into having some restraint as well, and really having the perspective that you should start small and build rather than start big and have to try and tread water.
Yeah, that's really good advice
Well, so
because.
here's an even better piece of practical advice. I give this to doctors all the time. So Meredith, you're going to start a DPC. You're going to start it tomorrow. Do you need an EMR today? No. You have no patients, okay? You need a phone number for them to call you. You need some way to schedule them, which could be the $10 calendar from Staples, okay? You need some way to document the visit, some way to take payment, and some way to reschedule them. Now, when you've got 100 patients, okay, maybe I need to have a little bit better system here. But that also comes down to thinking differently. You don't need a full-fledged membership management, practice management, EHR software system on day one because you have no patients. Okay? When you've got 50 or 75 or 100, and that gives you the time to figure out what is it that you really need as opposed to what you're being forced to work with. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's totally fine. Yeah, that's a good point. If you have no patience, then you don't need, a lot of stuff. So,
Why are you spending
yeah.
several hundred dollars on a system that you have no one that you have no patience for?
It puts you behind. Very good point.
Exactly. No, so I mean, they have these wonderful things called scanners now, where if you actually write something on a piece of paper, you can feed it into the machine and it turns that into a digital copy. And you can take that digital copy and you can store that on an electronic device.
Right.
Okay, so you're starting out. I have no patients. I have a $10 calendar from Staples, and I have a template form that I'm using for the visits. Now, I know that I'm going to continue to use that for a series of patients. Now, maybe you want something you probably will want for convenience is the ability to e-prescribe. But there are freestanding e-prescribing systems out there. So let's say you do that for a while and you've got 100 patients. Now I have 100 physical paper charts. Okay, why don't you find one of these newfangled scanning devices that you can feed everything into and upload it? That way you're, and it's not so much information that you're going to feel overwhelmed with having to populate whatever EMR you actually choose. It's still going to be pretty manageable, but you haven't laid out the expense for a fairly low, for fairly low return at the moment.
Yeah,
Right.
we get so wrapped up nowadays in, the world of EMRs and how they
Yeah.
work and how to click the right buttons, and they can be very useful, but they can also become a roadblock.
It totally can.
So for DOs or residents or students considering DPC, I know you've kind of given some advice, but is there any other advice about like skills, whether clinical, business, or personal, that are important to develop early on?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of this crazy radio host by the name of Dave Ramsey. Okay, he offers a 3-hour radio show, I think every other day of the week. And he has somewhat of a kind of religious bend to him. But the financial advice he offers is incredibly valuable. So just the financial advice alone, and most of it's on the personal side, like how to get out of debt and things of that nature. But the principles that he talks about, and there are other people that have the same, they have the same kind of mindset. I just mentioned this particular person because his radio show is free, which is great for people who don't have a whole lot of money. Okay. So it's free, FREE. So I think trying to wrap your head around some of those concepts to begin with makes implementing those concepts a whole lot easier on day one. As far as clinical skills, learn everything you possibly can, whether you like it or not, and whether you think you're going to use it or not, because you never know when you might need that. And the clinical skill that you hate the most might, in fact, teach you something that's applicable somewhere else, whether it's kinesthetic skills, how to hold an instrument, how to critically think about things, how to maneuver certain pieces of whatever. That's number two. And I will give the advice that my family physician gave me when I went to medical school, which was number one, if you don't know what's going on, you haven't asked the patient enough questions. And then part of that is if you still don't understand, if you still don't know what's going on, you haven't asked the patient enough questions. The patient will always tell you what's wrong with them if you probe and probe and probe and probe. Diagnostic tests should be confirmative, not hunt and peck. So you should have a good idea of why you are ordering a test rather than ordering a test to try and find something out.
Right.
You know, so I think the earlier we learn that, the more effective we are as physicians. And then along with that, honing up as many of your physical examination skills as you can, listening to, experiencing everything that you can, whether you like it or not, is going to be incredibly, incredibly helpful. And I think perhaps one of the more important things to remember is that when we become physicians, we become part of a very elite intellectual group worldwide. We, a very elite population, intellectually, not like we're better than anybody, but we're of a group of people whose intellectual capability is very, 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 very high. And you know, and not to say other people don't have skills in other sets, don't get me wrong, but just what we have to learn and remember and regurgitate and the critical thinking is really untapped. And the reason I mention that is that there are going to be a lot of jack wagons out there. They're gonna treat you as though you aren't part of that group. And so my word of empowerment is don't let them kill you. Okay. Don't let them get to you. Don't let the self-purported expert who doesn't know how to change a toilet seat tell you that you're changing the toilet seat wrong.
That's incredible advice and very empowering. I think a lot of times we can get hung up in our own gaps in knowledge. It's very easy to kind of look down on ourselves, but we just have to remember to, keep pushing through and being a continuous learner.
Well, you know, there's a time and a place for all of our associated colleagues, whether they're, you know, masters in public health or masters in this or masters in that. I'm not downplaying their role whatsoever. But what I am going to say is that you are the practicing physician, not that person. So while they may offer some great input, some great insight, and some great kind of added thinking, it is worth remembering that very few people can hang a frame on the wall that says Dr. so and so.
And I think even too, like, even from a primary care perspective, I feel like sometimes we're like, I don't like understand this one part of endocrinology or something. So then instead of kind of like figuring it out or learning about it, we're just so quick to like refer people to an endocrinologist.
So let me ask you this question. You send a patient to a specialist and they can't figure out what the problem is. Who do they then send the patient to?
Back to
Go
primary
back
care.
to your primary care physician. So then one could very understandably ask the question, so who's the smartest doctor in the room? If, and again, I don't mean to downplay the very appropriate addition and specialty knowledge that my specialty colleagues have, but they have a niche area of knowledge. So if it's not in their niche, they send them back to us. So then who has to be the most equipped? Who has to be, Bruce Wayne, Batman detective? Okay. Who has to be Sherlock Holmes? That's us. So we should not accept any self-awareness more than that.
I love that
Less
way of thinking.
than that, I mean.
I love that way of thinking. Final question here, especially in terms of DPC. Are there any resources, professionally, financially, or in any other capacity, that you suggest for students and residents who may be looking to follow this DPC model?
So as far as conferences, the DPC Summit has historically been fantastic. Nuts and Bolts is a very good conference as well. So, and that's those are generally very well populated. You're going to come across a lot of people. As far as organizations, certainly the ACOFP has some resources. The AAFP has some resources. The Direct Primary Care Alliance National Group has a lot of resources. And also check to see if you have a regional alliance. Like, for example, we have the New England Direct Primary Care Alliance here in Maine, and there's the Midwest, and there's this and this. So see if your area happens to have a group of direct primary care physicians in the area. As far as reading material, hands down, the best book to get, and if he listens to this, I'm going to be very upset, and that's Dr. Doug Farrago. Dr. Doug Farrago, MD, about starting up your own DPC practice. It's a fantastic book. It's on Amazon. I've known Doug for a very long time. It's really perhaps the best reading resource out there to learn more about getting yourself started in a DPC practice.
That's really good to hear, especially since DPC, I feel like it's kind of such a newer thing that it's nice that there are resources out there for students or physicians or anybody who
And
like
I will
wants to learn
also
more.
tell you the other resource are old farts like me. I mean, to be honest with you, most DPC docs are more than willing to share the joy.
Incredible.
We appreciate your guys' insight for sure.
Yeah.
We're all part of the same family.
No, it's truly inspirational. Like I said, when we first heard about this last year, it was pretty eye-opening, and it's helped at least me. I know I speak personally, it's helped me kind of gear what my career path might look like for the future. So, really appreciate it. Outside of our topic, I always like to throw in a fun question. Outside of stuff for DPC and medicine, do you have any other book recommendations for students or any other listeners out there, just
Sure.
for personal
House of God. House of God.
I got my copy right here, actually.
There you go.
I started
House of
reading it after you
God.
suggested it. I'm like, it's amazing.
I mean, some of it takes a little bit of intestinal fortitude to get through. But despite the age of the book, the power struggles, if you will, in the medical industrial complex are not that different now than they were then. It's a very poignant book. And I think the second book to read is the book you enjoy. The books that you enjoy. That would be the yeah. I think the books you enjoy. What well, could be comic books in my case. I enjoy comic books. I read comic books.
They count. Book is in the name.
And
So,
that's right. That's right.
all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr.
Well, thank you
Forbush.
very much.
ACOFP Student Podcast is a production of the American College of Osteopathic Family Physicians. To learn more about ACOFP, please visit www.acofp.org.